the obstacles there for you in your adult life are rooted in one of the earliest stages of your life. It brings you back to being a toddler. This episode is about young children, 2, 3, and 4-year-olds, and the sense of self that develops during those formative early years. Learning about this is an opportunity to understand why we are the way we are in our adult lives, and where we might be able to reparent the inner child living inside of us today. This episode has been sponsored by Michi and Naomi Nudel in honor of their grandparents. Relationships are too important and too challenging to take for granted. Welcome to The Attached Life, where we explore the magic and the madness of our most meaningful relationships. Do you have a hard time making choices, knowing what you want, being able to be in a situation and having the clear sense of, I can choose something, this is my preference? I may not always be able to have what I want. I may not always be able to execute exactly the way I want things to be or for things to work out exactly the way I envision them, but I have a clarity of what I want. And perhaps sometimes I don't have a clarity of what I want, but I have enough clarity. I can make decisions with resolution. I can have a sense, a strong enough sense of what it is that I want in a situation and the ability to make a choice. Choice is never perfect. Choice is never clear cut, or usually not, I shouldn't say never, but it's typically something that can be complex. But there are some people who have the ability to have clarity and have conviction in their choices, from the most simple and mundane things to the bigger, deeper, more complex things. And then there are a lot of people who struggle with this, a lot of people who have a difficult time making choices, knowing what it is that they want. Similarly, or a little bit differently, do you doubt your own ability to succeed? Do you doubt your ability to do things well, to be good at something? None of us are able to do things perfectly, but some of us have the ability, the sense that we have the capacity to succeed. We can engage in things. We can pursue certain ideas or goals. Again, from the most mundane to the biggest things, with a sense of belief in our capability, belief in the possibility of success. And then there are people who struggle with that, who feel that they can't engage from that place of believing in their own success. These two different categories that I just outlined, the first being the ability to have a sense of choice, of what it is that I want. Can I make choices? That has a lot to do with what we'd call shame. Shame is oftentimes the experience of not being able to experience my own desire or my own want, my own personality, my own preference. The second category that I try to outline, which has to do with the ability to succeed, the knowledge or the belief that I can succeed, has a lot to do with what we'd call self-doubt. I doubt my own capacity. I doubt my potential, my ability. So much of our lives, on a day-to-day basis, throughout our lives, in all different areas, in all the dimensions of our lives, involve decisions, big and small decisions. And all of them involve the capacity, the experience of knowing what it is that I want, having the ability to choose, and having the belief in myself and my potential for success. This comes up in the smallest ways, what it is that I'm going to eat for breakfast, or if I'm at a restaurant for dinner, what am I going to order from the menu? If I go shopping, if I need to buy a new shirt, and I'm in the store and I'm trying something on, can I notice my preferences? Can I have a sense of my desire, of my want? Where do I want to go if I have some time? How do I want to spend my time? And then, of course, it comes up in bigger contexts, like a career. Where do I want to live? Who do I want to be in an intimate relationship with? Who do I want to spend time with? What kind of community do I want to affiliate with? What kind of person do I want to be? Etc. If you struggle with these categories, these aspects of the human experience, shame that comes up in the context of decision making, of being able to sense your wants, your preferences, or if you struggle with self-doubt in your ability to sense that which it is that you desire to pursue and to believe in your capacity for success or to be successful enough. If you struggle with either of these categories, shame or self-doubt, it could be, not always, but there's a very good chance that actually what you're experiencing as an adult that gets in the way of being able to make choices and what gets in the way as an adult of the ability to be able to pursue that which it is that you want to pursue actually is rooted. The obstacles there for you in your adult life are rooted in one of the earliest stages of your life. Brings you back to being a toddler. We spoke last time a lot about the newborn stage. And the newborn baby stage has to do with trust and mistrust. Will my cries be heard? Will my needs be tended to? If they are, I develop a sense of trust. If they're not, I develop a sense of mistrust of the world. And we expanded on that and we tried to explore that deeply in the last episode. Right after that stage, what starts to develop is actually kind of the opposite or other side, the other pole of the human experience, which is not necessarily my trust of others, but it's really, in a sense, my trust of myself. It's my sense of autonomy, of me as an individual. So let's back up a second. If I get stalled in that earliest stage of developing trust or not developing trust, if I get stuck there because I don't find that I can trust the people around me, I don't find that I can trust the world around me, and again, of course, all of this is happening unconsciously because we're talking about a newborn baby. So this is happening in the body. This is happening in the felt sense. This is happening in the foundational layer of the brain and of the developing person, not in a consciously processed way, but in a way that is deeply ingrained. It's in the earliest mapping out of the neurochemistry and of the nervous system, of the felt sense of existence in this world, of a sense of identity. And if in that context I develop a sense of mistrust of the world, so then what's going to happen is I'm actually going to become deeply self-sufficient because I'm going to have the sense that I can't rely on other people. I can't trust that other people are going to help me in any way, that no one's going to be there for me. So in that sense, I'm going to develop almost what we might call a hyper self-sufficiency, a extreme version of self-sufficiency, which makes a lot of sense. And actually in that context, is deeply brilliant, is so adaptive, even if later in life that's going to manifest in forms that will oftentimes present problems and challenges for the person. But if you think about it in its original context, it's an adaptive solution to a problem. If I can't trust the world around me, then I need to invest my efforts further into my self-sufficiency. Of course, that's going to hinder me in the context of developing relationships and so many other things later in life, but in its earliest stage, it's actually an adaptive solution. But I want to focus on today is if trust does develop, so if I do feel that people hear my cries, that people tend to my needs as a baby, so then I start to develop a trust in other people. And when that happens, when there is trust in others, now I can start to venture off to explore the world in my own way. I can start to express my individuality. I can start to individuate myself, to become my own person with my own wants and needs. I can start to engage that and to start to test that out, to feel what that's like. What happens if I start to have preferences, if I start to express wants? Does the environment allow for that? But not in a hyper-autonomous way, not in an extreme self-sufficiency, because I do have a sense that I can trust others. People will do things for me. People will help me. People will be there for me if I need them. So it's not a overcompensation by engaging in a extreme form of self-sufficiency and individuality. It's from a place of, I can trust the world around me. I can trust my relationship with other people that they can help me. And now from that place, I start to desire my own self. I start to be interested in what would it be like to have my own expression of personality, of being in this world. And this brings us to the second stage in Erikson's developmental theory, which is what he calls autonomy versus shame and self-doubt. So if I have trust from that earliest stage, so now I'm going to start to develop a deeper version of trust. What do I mean by a deeper version of trust? So think about the following sentence. I trust that you take care of me. So as a child, as a baby, my system, my internal system is gauging whether or not I can trust that you will take care of me. But think about how that sentence can actually be formulated in two different ways with the exact same words, depending on how I emphasize the words. There's a difference between, I trust that you take care of me, versus, I trust that you take care of me. The way I think about it is that the earliest stage is the emphasis on take care. I trust that you take care of me, that you're going to do what I need, that the things that need to happen are going to be taken care of. I'm going to be fed, my diaper is going to be changed, I'm going to be kept safe, I'm going to be kept warm, etc. Once that's there, now I start to engage in the experimentation with, can I trust that you'll take care of me? Will you still take care of me? Will you still have space for me when there's a me that's here? When I start to express my own wants and my own needs in a more individualized way, meaning it's not just the generic cry of needing to be fed. It's not just the generic need to have a diaper changed. It's not just the generic or objective universal need for safety and warmth and shelter and clothing, etc. But now it becomes my particular version of what it means that I need clothing. It's the clothing that I want. That it's my particular need of what I want to eat, how I want to eat it, when I want to eat it. So not just that I need to be fed in a basic way, but how I want to experience that. Not just that I need shelter, but that I have my personal preferences of what shelter looks like, of what stuffed animal is on my bed, or what color is in my room, or things of that nature. And I start to experiment with that. And so the child at this earliest age is now, as a toddler, in simple, seemingly mundane ways, is going to start to want to be doing things on their own. They're going to want to start expressing themselves on their own. And whether or not they're going to thrive in that context and develop that healthy sense of self, healthy sense of autonomy, or if they're going to develop shame around their sense of self and self-doubt around their sense of self, that's going to depend largely on the responses that they get from the adults around them. And this becomes really challenging for a lot of parents, because when your child is getting dressed for school in the morning, a little kid, a three-year-old, or is getting dressed to go to shul on Shabbos morning, and they want to wear the same outfit that they've worn for the past 3 months in a row, and you just spent money to buy them a new yuntif outfit or new clothing for school, and you want them to wear the new thing you bought them. But that's not what they want to wear. They want to wear the thing that they love wearing. What happens in that moment? Or you care how they look and you want them to look matching, but they pick out a top and a bottom that totally mismatch, and they are adamant that that's what they want to wear. How do you react to that? Let's say they want to try pouring the milk into their cereal on their own in the morning for breakfast, and you know that that's going to likely result in some sort of spill. What do you do in that moment? they want to tie their shoes themselves, but that's going to take a really long time. And mornings with kids are really stressful and really hectic. And you don't have time for them to have to try tying their shoes 10 times in a row and actually in the end still not get it right. Or to put on their coat themselves. And you're rushing. And what do you do in those moments? And the answer obviously can't be that we always let our children get whatever they want, do whatever they want at all costs, no matter what. That's actually not going to be safe for them either. They're not going to feel taken care of. That's going to actually bring them back to a sense of mistrust because there's no container. There's no stability. There's no sense of borders that are keeping me in a place that is stable. Everything feels too hectic, too chaotic, too open, too loose. And also, if everything is just allowed at any time, it doesn't actually allow for me to feel that my choices are my choices. It's not that I have significance in choosing what I want, because it's just complete openness, complete exposure to whatever anybody chooses to do at any given moment. So in all those situations where the child begins to try and do the typical developmental child-type things of expressing their own wants and their own desire to be autonomous, but it creates and presents all sorts of challenges, how do we react to that? And depending on how we react to that, the child is going to develop a sense of healthy autonomy or a sense of shame and self-doubt. So what the child really needs in this stage of developing their autonomy versus their shame and self-doubt is a healthy balance of being given opportunities to express and experiment and be themselves and try to be themselves and try to do things on their own as much as possible, but still within containment and within balance. There is a reality to life. There is a practicality to life. And actually, as I said before, the child needs the answer sometimes to be no, because they need to start at some point in this process to also develop a sense of being able to experience and integrate into their system that sometimes the answer is no, and that actually will feel very stabilizing for them in many ways. That's something we can try and get to at a different point. But the question is, how do we say no? And how within the no do we allow that for that not to be shaming and not to be stifling? And how do we find as much expression as possible within a contained way that the child does have the ability to not say, well, I want my room to be pink today, and then I want my room to be blue or green, and you know they're just going to somehow change the color of their room all the time. That's obviously completely impractical. But when we say no to that, can we say no in a way that isn't shaming the desire? Can we celebrate the fact that they have an interest? Oh, your favorite color is pink. Well, we can't paint your room pink because your room is gray, but what could we do that could bring pink into your room or whatever color it might be? They want to choose their snacks in the morning for school, and instead of getting upset or frustrated or shaming them for wanting to pick all junk snacks or rushing them through the fact that there's no time for that, what would a response of, well, I need to pick most of your snacks because I need to make sure that you have a healthy day of eating, but I'd love for you to be able to pick one snack that's the one you want the most, and that can be one that you choose. Or if it's a particularly rushed day, today we don't have time for you to choose, but I would love for you to choose. You can choose snacks tomorrow, and let's plan for that so that we have enough time to make that happen. Similarly, if they want to tie their shoes themselves or put on their coat themselves, to be able to say to them, well, right now we actually have to get going so we can be to school on time, but how about after school? you can try practicing tying your shoes yourself so that maybe tomorrow you can do it on your own. Or things like that. To be very mindful and intentional in the way that we respond, the way that we talk to them, to children, in a way that it doesn't stifle or suppress the desire to do things on their own. That they can feel that their desire to do things on their own is actually embraced and empowered and celebrated. That doesn't mean the answer is always yes, but it's how we respond to it. And here's why this is so deeply important. Because what happens if we don't do that? What happens if our responses are always aggravated responses, rushing responses, stifling responses, kind of shutting them down, not really allowing for that to take place? What happens is the following. The need for a person in their developmental experience, the need for a person to express their own wants, their own autonomy, their own ability to do things on their own, that need is programmed as a basic natural impulse and instinct that we as humans have. That is something that's there. Whether or not the environment encourages that and cultivates that and nurtures that, that basic impulse is there. That's going to be coming up in the child, in the person, in their system. It's going to be happening. So what that means is that when that instinct to be more autonomous, to express the self more, to have my own particular preferences and my own desire to do things on my own, when that comes up, because it is going to be there, it's programmed in our basic being that we are going to have that desire to do those things. If it's stifled, then what happens is that it's suppressed. It's not that it doesn't happen or it's not there. It's there, but it's suppressed. And when it's suppressed, our system will then need to adapt to it and orient into a kind of unnatural reconfiguration to somehow manage in this system where my basic natural need is not able to be manifest. It's not able to happen. So now I need to do something with that. I need to somehow reconfigure myself in a way that allows for me to exist in this environment that doesn't really allow for my natural self. And one of the ways that that's going to manifest, because we need to survive, we need to continue existing somehow, is by reorienting our sense of self away from a healthy sense of autonomy and into a place of shame or self-doubt. And let me use this as an opportunity to try and explain an incredibly important concept. And along with this concept, I'll actually throw out a question that I think is something that comes up in the context of these kinds of topics a lot. I think it's a very important question as a kind of side point. The concept is as follows. When there's a basic need, a basic developmental characteristic that is not being allowed to be expressed by virtue of the environment, by the caregivers, let's say the parents, respond to this basic need of autonomy in a way that is stifling to it. So the child now has one of two options. So let's imagine this scenario. The child, as a very small little being, a three-year-old, who is tiny compared to these giants, these people, these parents who are just giants in the eyes of a three-year-old. And the three-year-old is completely dependent on these giants for everything, for clothing, food, shelter, warmth, safety, everything. Their whole life is in the hands of these giants. And they are experiencing, the three-year-old is experiencing, that there's something that doesn't feel right in the experience that they are having with these giants, with these people, with their parents. Something doesn't feel right. Something feels off. When they express their interest in eating dinner on the green plate instead of the purple plate, the parent makes them feel dumb about it or just gets upset, gets angry about it. So the child can now interpret that. This is all happening unconsciously. The child can interpret that experience in one of two ways. Now, of course, if these things happen all the time, if it happens once in a while, but the general environment is different, that's not what I'm talking about. But if this happens in a more pervasive way, in a more chronic way, so the child has one of two options in that moment. They can either interpret the parent's anger at their desire to have the green plate instead of the purple plate. They can experience the parent's anger as indicative of there being something wrong with the parent. The parent is doing something wrong. The parent is the problem. Why is my parent so angry? My parent gets angry so much. Do they have an anger issue? Is there something going on for them? Did they have a stressful day at work, or are they in a fight with someone? What's going on for them? There's a problem with them. There's something wrong with them that they're getting angry. My desire for the green plate is perfectly natural and normal and makes sense, but there's something going on with my parent. That's one option of an unconscious interpretation of what's going on, of the parent's anger. The other interpretation, unconscious interpretation, is my parent's anger makes perfect sense because there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with my desire in the green plate. There's something wrong with me wanting to tie my shoes myself. There's something wrong with me asking for a different stuffed animal on my bed. There's something wrong with me saying I don't like this dinner tonight, whatever it might be. There's something wrong with me, and my parents' response is perfectly justified. So if you're a three-year-old and you have these parents who are physically giants and figuratively speaking giants, meaning they run everything, everything's in their hands. So think about it. Which of those interpretations feels more safe and which feels more dangerous? To think that there's something wrong with me, the three-year-old, or to think that there's something wrong with my parents who control the whole universe from my perspective? Clearly, it is far more scary, far more dangerous for that three-year-old to think there's something wrong with the parents. And so what happens is that the three-year-old therefore unconsciously interprets and internalizes a negative self-perception. There's something wrong with me for wanting the green plate. There's something wrong with me for saying that I want to tie my shoes myself. And now the child develops a sense of shame around their wants. They develop a sense of self-doubt around their capacities. But by doing that, they actually survive. They actually feel in that moment more safe, because if there's something wrong with me, well, then that means that actually my parents' response makes sense and my parents are good. And if my parents are good, being that they're the giants, they control my whole world, that feels a lot more safe. And in the moment, that makes so much sense. In the long run, what that's going to mean is that this child now, years later, as an adult, is going to struggle with choices, with knowing what they want, knowing who they are, and with the belief in themselves and their capacity to pursue things and to have the potential of success. The question I want to throw out there as a little bit of a side point is, because of that understanding as to how negative self-beliefs develop, one of the tricky things that come up in the context of therapy a lot is that in order to undo that negative self-belief, we often need to be able to shift where the problem was. And we need to shift that interpretation of identifying the problem as being in ourselves and be able to move it away and into seeing where the problem actually was and not in ourselves. The goal is not to say where the problem was, because the goal is not to criticize others. The goal is to be able to reorient towards my sense of self, so that instead of understanding that there's something wrong with me for having had wants, that no, it's perfectly good that I have wants and preferences. But in order to make that change, oftentimes what that means is being able to see, well, then where was the problem in the environment back then? If it wasn't me, where was it? And that often means that it was in adults around me. And that brings us into a tricky thing, because that is where people then start to create a lot of oftentimes resentment or animosity towards parental figures. And there's a very hot topic these days and debate around concepts of parental alienation and issues in therapy, turning children against their parents, and therapy doing all sorts of things like that. And that is not a goal that I'm pro, but it is a tricky kind of tightrope to walk. Because if we understand that oftentimes, in order to make that shift around our own beliefs of self, we need to go back to that place and understand what was happening and why we internalized that negative belief, and to be able to work that in a way that we develop that healthier belief, it does involve oftentimes a bit of reorienting to the way we understand the people that were around us at that time and what was going on. So I do think that there's a whole variety of different ways to try and deal with that issue, and to do it in a way that is compassionate and respectful and understanding of the adult figures that were there, and that we can shift where the problem was without having to overly blame or criticize or judge or alienate those adult figures, those parental figures. I think there is a way to do that. But it is an open question, because I do think it's a very fine line, and it's a very subtle and complex art form of how to try and navigate that. Not a simple thing at all, because the goal certainly is not to turn people against their families. But there is an element that comes up in a way that's really very tricky. So just putting that out there as food for thought. But coming back to where we're at, this is why there are many adults that later in life struggle with being able to simply walk into a shoe store and comfortably buy a pair of shoes, or go to a restaurant and comfortably choose what they want to order without it being a very stressful experience. And on a much bigger scale, to be able to choose a career or choose a life partner. Because in that earliest stage, they developed as a survival mechanism a negative self-belief around the experience of having wants, having preferences, believing in themselves, and they developed a lot of shame around that. I want to mention a few different reasons why the environment, the adult people, the parents can oftentimes create that sense of shame. Almost always unintentionally. It's almost never something that people are trying to do. But it can happen for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it happens that the parents respond to the child's desire to do things themselves, to express their wants and preferences. The parents will kind of respond in a shaming or angry way to that, or impatient way. Sometimes it's really just a practical thing. Sometimes it's a lack of realizing how important it is to nurture the child's desire and the child's preferences and the child's interest in doing things on their own. And it's just a lack of realizing how important that is, and the busyness of life, especially when our children are that young. It's extremely challenging. It's a very challenging time. And so the busyness of life and the impatience and the amount that people are juggling can oftentimes, just in a very simple kind of surface level way, lead to that sense of stifling or suppressing the child's interest in expressing themselves and being more autonomous. Sometimes it can actually have to do, and I think this is an important one to understand, it can have to do with financial situations. If a child gets the sense that the parents are very stressed or very tight financially, and the parents don't do what they need to do in order to, because it may not be their fault at all if the budget is very tight, that's perfectly reasonable and understandable, and a situation that a lot of people are in. But the question is, how do we manage that? How do we navigate that? And if the child picks up on a parent's stress and constriction around that, the child is going to feel burdened by the parent's anxiety around that, and therefore they're going to feel something wrong in having a want or having a preference or expressing or asking for something. And so a lot of shame will develop in general around having wants because of a sense of trying to almost lighten their own parents' burden by not asking for things or not wanting things. Sometimes it can be a religious constriction if the child experiences a parent or a system or an environment or a school as having a very constricted religious orientation or a very constricted range of what it means to be a good person or a good Jew or whatever the cultural or religious norms are, if it's a very constricted and very rigid form, so the child is not going to get the sense that there's any room for their own preferences or their own personality. And so that's going to create the shame and the self-doubt around their own sense of self. In a different way, it can sometimes be the parent's own anxiety. It could be from parents being anxious. That's oftentimes what can result in what we talk about of, you know, helicopter parents, or I think people now talk about bulldozer parents, right? So people, parents who are overprotective, parents who are from their own anxiety, they see their kid running down the block. And the kid is running, and as kids do, they often trip, and they'll skin their knee or something like that, and get a scrape, and that happens, and that's okay. But the overprotective parent is going to run and try and stop the child before they fall, and not allow the parent to have that child experience of running freely down the street. And again, it's all within balance, but that anxiety that can create the overprotection, the over cushioning of everything around the child to make sure that the child experiences no harm and no mistakes and nothing ever spills and nothing ever goes wrong, that's actually not protecting the child. It's actually creating a sense of shame and self-doubt that the child thinks that they can't be themselves, they can't try things. Oftentimes that can also come from a parent's own trauma, which will come out and surface in the context of their parenting. So just understanding these different forms of how that stage of autonomy versus shame and self-doubt, the different factors that can come up for the parents that will influence and impact that. So bringing this all together, because again, our focus in this is not actually so much on the parenting per se, but is on the child in ourselves. So for the last piece of this episode, I want to try and offer you some techniques here. If you find yourself struggling with any of the shame or self-doubt that we've been talking about, so notice what that feels like in your body. If you can pause and slow down, if you can listen to this in a quiet space with nothing else going on, and you can take a moment to notice, what do you notice in your body? If you think about making a choice, having a preference, thinking of something that you wish you could pursue, what does that bring up for you? What do you notice? What sensations do you notice in your body? Alternatively, or continuing from there, if you think about the early stages of your life, of what it was like to be a young, young child, somewhere around the age of 3. If you have any visual memory, that's great. If you don't, that's also okay. And just be curious what your unconscious memory brings up for you. The body is always the revealer of the unconscious. So what do you notice in your body as you think about that, as you think about everything we've spoken about here? The examples I've given. Can you picture yourself at that age? What do you see when you picture yourself? What's that like? Is there a pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant experience of thinking about this stage of life? And as we did last time, can you think about a corrective experience for this 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old? Can you picture a situation in which he or she may have had a preference around something and it was stifled? Imagine the situation, a classic situation of a grandparent, let's say, wanting to give their grandchild a hug or a kiss, and the grandchild doesn't want that right now as a 3-year-old. Unfortunately, what most parents and grandparents do is kind of force it on them. Can you imagine the ideal scenario for you? How the parents and grandparents in that situation would have responded in a way that would have been better. I tried to be mindful of this myself very recently when one of my kids said to me that they don't like when I get hyper. Kind of an interesting moment. So I try to be mindful of this by responding, by telling them that I'm happy that they told me, and thank you for telling me that, and I'll try to remember that next time, to do it differently, to act differently. What if there's a joke that one of your parents made, or a way that they acted that you really didn't like? If you told them that you didn't like their sarcasm or their joke, can you imagine what would you have wanted their response to be? What do you wish for? If there was financial strain, can you envision what you wish things could have looked like? Which doesn't necessarily mean having more money, but how your wants could have been nurtured in a way that was in line with the reality of what was going on. If there was religious constriction, what do you wish the religious messages would have been instead? If your parents were overprotective from their own anxiety, what do you wish things could have looked like instead? And picture whatever it is that you're imagining, and notice what it's like in your body to envision and imagine a different experience, the fantasy version of your experience, where your wants and preferences, in a balanced and contained way, were celebrated and embraced. Where the messages you got told you that your autonomous self was exactly what the environment around you wanted. It wasn't a problem. It wasn't something that got in the way. Even if it couldn't always be carried out exactly the way you wanted, but your wants were wanted. That the environment around you wanted to hear what you wanted. And taking this one last step further, there's an exercise that you can try of doing what we call some inner child work. So in your life now, could you try something as crazy as imagine on a Sunday morning that you wake up and you allow your 3-year-old self to choose what you wear that day? Maybe you can't do it on a day you have to go to work. Maybe you can't even do it on a day that you have to leave the house. Maybe you can do it for an hour while you're still home and your 3-year-old self chooses a completely mismatched outfit. but you can do it for an hour. Or the next time you have a little bit of time in your day, you can ask your three-year-old self what he or she would like to do with that time. Maybe they want to go for ice cream. Can you let your three-year-old self choose the ice cream flavor you get? And the answer to the choices, the preferences of that inner child, again, might not always be yes in a completely giving them whatever they want way, but how do you communicate the no if it's a no? How do you work with whatever it is that they prefer, that they're wanting, in a way that empowers and celebrates their autonomous self? That they can feel, that that inner child feels not just that they're cared for, but that someone cares about me, that there's a me. Can you live with that inner child, bringing them with you, and in the proper, appropriate contexts, giving them a voice, nurturing that sense of individuality?